From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio, science and technology that is accessible and entertaining. And if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Katie Mullally. First, this morning, we speak with neuroscientist and Dr. Kieran Fox, who joins us to explore Albert Einstein's little discussed spirituality and how it both informed and complemented his science. Then, professor and author Timothy Morton joins to explore what it means to be ecological and what sorts of actions count as we are moving into an age of mass extinction. Stay tuned for these guests. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Katie Mullally. Albert Einstein remains renowned around the world for revolutionizing our understanding of the cosmos. But very few realize that the celebrated scientist had a deep spiritual side. Einstein wrote extensively about his quest to create a cosmic religion divorced from religious dogma, a worldview that would unite humanity in a shared experience of identifying with the infinite.
Our next guest is physician scientist Kieran Fox. He has written about this largely unknown side of the great physicist and icon, Einstein's world in which mysticism met mathematics, reality was revered, and the human mind was honored as a mirror of the infinite. Dr. Kieran Fox studied medicine at Stanford University. He holds a doctorate in cognitive neuroscience from the University of British Columbia and joins us now to discuss his new book called I Am Part of Infinity, The Spiritual Journey of Albert Einstein. Kieran Fox, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. Nice to be here with you guys.
Well, it's great to have you, and we love this book. And especially in this day and age, there's like this battle between religion and science. And if someone says they're religious, the other person says, well, I believe in science, which means that you don't believe in religion, I guess. Talk a little bit about that divide and why you were so interested in bringing these two things sort of together by talking about Einstein.
Yeah, I think the way Einstein bridges the divide is what people today would call spiritual but not religious. So it is a reconciliation of science and religion in some sense, but it's not so much science proving or supporting most of our traditional religious beliefs. And the idea for Einstein was more that the religious impulses, the sense of something being started part of something bigger, or the sense of, you know, the purpose or the mystery of our cosmos, these kind of feelings, these intrinsic religious impulses were really valuable and sort of inalienable from being part of human, and could be put, you know, expressed or channeled in different directions, including science. But that didn't mean that we could necessarily, you know, carry forward with our traditional religious beliefs. So it's kind of a special mix of science and religion that is not what most people would expect. And of course, it's been pretty much the whole book trying to explain what that is. So it's not a short answer to that. And then the reason why I wanted to do this is because these have always been two parts of my life. I've been interested, you know, my dad got me interested in dreams when I was very young, and I was reading, you know, Carl Jung and Freud. And then I started meditating also very young, was introduced by a high school teacher, ended up living in Buddhist monasteries in various parts of the world. So I've always had that spiritual side of my own life. And yet I was interested in science from a very early age, and of course ended up doing, becoming a neuroscientist and then studying medicine. So there's no conflict in my life, but it's also, I didn't come to it from a traditional path of growing up you know, with a religious upbringing. But at the same time, what we were talking about, like all these intrinsic impulses and these sort of, you know, possibility of altered states of mind have always been, you know, front and center in my own life. So it was sort of trying to find some synthesis of those two things.
So what you're saying then, in your experience, that you've always lived in this world in which you could bridge the gap, was there ever a conflict for you between the two? Or have you always just been able to explain to yourself how and why you see the two as connected between spirituality and science, for example?
Yeah, there's never been a conflict for me personally, but that doesn't mean I haven't come into conflict over this topic. I actually describe in the intro to the book, I was living in a Tibetan Buddhist monastery in Nepal for some time, and they have, you know, as open as they are, I think the Tibetan people and the Tibetan resident is extremely open-minded, very open to Westerners and so on. So, and they're pretty relaxed about most of the metaphysics and the faith and so on. But at the same time, pretty much every religious tradition sort of comes at things with this final package of answers, and they're not usually open to anything fundamental changing. And that's kind of the impression I was getting after living there for quite a while, was that you don't really need to ask any more questions. You don't really need to wonder. There is an answer. You know, you look in the Buddhist texts or you look in the famous commentaries, and that's kind of, it's all over. It's kind of done. And science, of course, is the opposite, where, you know, we think we know certain things, but it's this open-ended, open system where the whole point is to keep asking questions and to keep challenging things. So that's basically why I left, is that not that anyone in particular was forcing me to swallow any particular beliefs, but at the same time, the overall worldview is kind of a closed system. And what I love about Einstein's idea of religion or the cosmic religion is not only that it's compatible with science, but the whole point is it's also aligned with this idea that questioning is a good thing, that curiosity is a divine mystical drive. So it's not just, oh, it happens to not offend scientific sensibilities, or it doesn't conflict with cosmology. Like that'd be nice, even if we could get that from religion. And that's all I was really hoping for. But with his worldview, it's actually, you know, the scientific drive is a mystical, you know, religious thing. And scientific truths are kind of like religious revelations in his worldview. So it was more than I hoped for, honestly, when I figured out what he really believed in. So.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with physician, scientist, and author Kieran Fox. He's written a book called I Am Part of Infinity, The Spiritual Journey of Albert Einstein. Well, Kieran, you start the book with a letter from Einstein that says a human being is a part of the whole, and he's meaning the universe. How do you think Einstein's willingness to be a part of the whole, if you will, and not separate from spiritualities, separate from that wholeness, helped him create the amazing scientific advancements and discoveries and theories that he did?
Yeah, he talks about this quite specifically as the, you know, his daily efforts and his daily work to keep coming up with new theories and new breakthroughs as essentially religious work. You know, like almost like prayer for him. And he has a quote, I'm just paraphrasing because I don't remember the exact quote, but he says it's the daily effort comes straight from the heart. You know, there's no real effort. There's no kind of top-down control. It's just, this is who and what I am. And that's how I express it, is this yearning to find unity, this yearning to find oneness through science and through mathematics. So, and he spoke about that historically as well as what he imagines was the drive that allowed, you know, Kepler and Galileo and Newton to keep going and going and to really revolutionize things in their own time, often at great personal costs and, you know, great expense in terms of safety and, you know, the hatred of their peers and condemnation from the religious authorities and so on. And so I think that's the positive side of it. The negative side, which I do get into a little bit near the end of the book, is that he was so obsessed with this idea that, you know, by almost everybody's account, all his colleagues and all physicists since he died, is that he basically wasted the last 30 to 40 years of his life in this fruitless search for the ultimate equation. And it was the same search. He was looking for a unifying equation to unite electromagnetism and gravity, which is still what a lot of people are looking for now, including the quantum level as well. So most physicists and string theorists are looking for some ultimate unifying theory. But they agree that the way Einstein was doing it was just not going to be workable in the long term. So it's a drive that gives you kind of almost unlimited energy, and in his case, at least, did provide a lot of really, really valuable insights in the first half of his career as a scientist. And yet, you know, arguably it can kind of lead to obsession and this quest for things that maybe you can't attain. So,
well, you mentioned Galileo and Copernicus earlier, and they received a massive amount of pushback from the church. But in reading your book, Einstein received pushback from fellow scientists. Why were they, I don't want to say afraid to look at the way things the way Einstein did, but what was their pushback against his incorporation, if you will, of the natural sense of order?
Yeah, I think it was more the direction he was coming at it from that they disagreed about. I think everyone was looking for a unifying theory as well. But Einstein, even though he kind of inaugurated the quantum revolution with his work on the photon, he didn't really take much of that into account. His theory, he was using classical theories that, you know, there's fields and there's waves of light and gravitational waves and so on. So he was working from this very old school physics, and everyone else was using quantum physics. And he didn't even try to incorporate, it wasn't really a theory of everything the way we talk about it now, because he wasn't even trying to incorporate what they had learned so far about inside the atom and what we now call the nuclear forces. Those even weren't even discovered until pretty late in his life. So he was kind of working on the fringes in their mind. You know, he's looking at these old classical theories, cosmic scales, fields and waves, and everyone else is looking at quantum waves of probability in this very strange realm inside the atom. And I covered some of this in the book, where Wolfgang Pauli and Werner Heisenberg also tried to come up with this unified theory, and they ultimately failed, but they thought they really had it. And so I think that's part of it, is everyone, including Einstein, saw that quantum physics has been so successful. It's mind-boggling, but it's such an effective model. It's the greatest thing we've ever built in science, hands down, and that remains true to this day. And they thought, you have to approach it from this angle, and we're going to build up from here, and the rest of it will fall into place. But Einstein's coming at it from completely the wrong direction, using all this old school math and theory, and it's never going to work. And it's understandable given the success that they had early on. But then they hit these kind of roadblocks, and here we are. You know, it's been 70 years since Einstein died, and we're really no closer. There's no theory that's unifying the quantum and then the large scale, you know, general relativity, cosmic scale of things. So I think it's an understandable problem they had. And yet, you know, both of them ended up at dead ends in the end.
That's really interesting, Kieran. And I'm wondering, you know, as you talk through this, I would imagine that some of our listeners are saying, wait, I don't even really understand quantum theory, and this is all not making sense. Yeah, that was going to be my point, is that every time we've asked physicists, you know, can you explain quantum physics? It is this very, you know, it's nebulous in a way, but then it's not. And so I guess I would encourage our listeners to hang in there, because what you're really doing is looking at this whole world in kind of a new and really kind of enlightened way. And it makes me wonder why, you know, so Einstein, for example, you say he was a traditionalist and a classicist in terms of physics, and he was kind of an old style. And yet with his the things that influenced his way of thinking, you know, it makes you think that he did have mystical experiences, if not religious experiences. Let's call them mystical experiences. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, just to go back a little bit, I think his way of looking for unified theory was quite old school, but at the same time, Einstein himself did all this revolutionary stuff. And as I mentioned, he kind of, and I didn't actually know this till I was researching the book, many of the key ideas of quantum physics he had first and published first, but the overall interpretation he kind of rejected. So it's not that he rejected, you know, quantum energy states or even spontaneous changes in energy. These were ideas he had first, and he actually mentored a lot of the early quantum physicists, recommended them for the Nobel Prizes, kept pushing for it until they got it. So he really, really admired this work, but he sort of approached the oneness and the big scale theories from a different point of view. And I think that's kind of where he got stuck with it. The mystical experiences of, you know, contemplating physics is a really, I think it's my favorite part of the book, honestly. It's just such a crazy topic. And I think an important thing to point out is that this wasn't just Einstein. You actually trace this back. All the great physicists who found kind of unifying theories and equations felt like they'd been given a divine revelation or a gift from God or something. And I think this was interpreted more literally back in the scientific revolution, where Kepler allegedly fell to his knees and said, God, I'm thinking your thoughts after you. And when Newton published his Principia Mathematica, there's a picture of him reclining in the clouds, and there's kind of this angelic muse like being kind of talking to him, whispering the secrets of the universe. So I think it's a really old idea that I trace back to Pythagoras and the Pythagorean school, that math is it's not just another mental model. It's not just another theory. In their minds, there's something really, really special and unique about mathematics. And this is, for all intents and purposes, this is the language of the universe, or the language of the, you know, divine rational order that somehow holds the universe together, is probably how Einstein would have thought about it. And again, it's not just an analogy there. I mean, we can debate whether that's true, whether math is just an effective model or truly the sort of software or the hardware of the universe, however you like to think about it. But the revelations that you get when you find an effective equation, Einstein very much describes as ecstatic religious experiences. And there's one quote in particular where, before, you know, the famous result that proved general relativity was the light deflection result, where they showed that light is bent by the gravity of our sun to an exact degree that corresponds to his theory. But before that, it was less popular and less well known in the world, but he knew it was a confirmation. There's this tiny irregularity in the orbit of Mercury that no one could explain, because regular theories of gravity, you know, Newton's theory of gravity just doesn't predict it and doesn't make sense of it, but general relativity does. And that was confirmed earlier. So it was kind of a private thing for him, but he realized this was confirmation, and he wrote a letter to a friend saying, you know, I was beside myself with ecstasy for days. So he was just like riding high on the confirmation of this. And he described the key insights as, he said it was a rapture, almost in a, you know, almost a rapture, an illumination, that ideas come from God. And again, these are metaphorical expressions for him. I hope that's clear. But yeah. At the same time, it's kind of, you know, the experience is the experience, however you interpret it is another thing. But the feeling of rapture, ecstasy, gifts from the divine is very much how he describes his highest mathematical insights.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Well, the metaphorical aspect of it, yes, I get that. You know, it comes from the divine, it comes from God. But if we get down to just the literal aspect of it, did Einstein believe in God? And if so, what kind of God? And tell us about that.
I think that really comes down to semantics. And that's also a large section of the book, is trying to tease that all apart. And I think the shortest and best answer is no, absolutely not. Not in the way that almost anybody thinks of it, and not in the way that anyone uses that word today. But of course, there's more to it. And just so I guess I stake my ground out of where I am on that is, you know, that's the biblical God is what I think most people think of with that word, and what I think of. And this is someone who has, you know, personality and a mind and judges and rewards people and has a purpose set up for the world, and for many people believe, you know, a purpose for everyone's life, and, you know, sets down the moral laws. I think that's, you know, the cartoon version of the typical God that people are thinking of. And in that sense, the answer is absolutely no. Einstein over and over again said that kind of God is something he has no belief in whatsoever. And what he does point to is Spinoza's God, and he says that multiple times as well, that Spinoza's God is what I can believe in, or you can call it pantheism. And that's a much bigger or a much more subtle conversation to have, because it's so unfamiliar to people today. But it's actually pretty closely in line with what we've been talking about, which is that it's not really anything personal or anything outside of what we can experience, but it's the immanent power, let's say, or the immanent order in the universe is what God is. And I think for physicists, it's much easier to appreciate that and to feel that reverence, because they realize how complex and how beautifully harmonious that order actually is. And I think anyone who studies physics can appreciate that. And the more you study it, the more you feel it, I think, because you realize this is not just, oh, there's like one or two laws of gravity. There's a whole set of laws, a whole suite of forces, and they all work in a very, very harmonious, very precise way. And there's no glitches and there's no mistakes. There's just this integrated system, and it allows for all this stability and complexity to arise, and life and consciousness, all these things can arise within this matrix that seems like it's built of pretty simple parts and pretty simple laws, but it allows for all this stuff to arise within it. And that's what he's talking about in terms of God. So it's not, and it's also not just quite the same as saying it's just the world or it's just the universe. That's true, but you need to sort of look at the deeper underlying order and structure and harmony of the universe. And that's what blows their mind. It's not just, oh, the universe is big and there's trillions and trillions of atoms. And so that's, you know, big things with lots, you know, big numbers. That's impressive. Let's call it God. It's not that. It's the harmonious structure of it that is creating this feeling of reverence for them. So.
Karen, you mentioned Spinoza briefly, and I hadn't heard of Spinoza because I don't really delve into philosophy much, but fascinating person and subject, if you will. But what were these philosophical and mystical influences that Einstein looked to? Because, you know, we hear so much about scientists making these massive discoveries that they were built upon the backs of other scientists and discoveries, but Einstein turned to this other realm so often for so much of his insight and inspiration.
Yeah, well, Spinoza's one of them. I think there's a lot of other scientists too who inspired him with, you know, their mathematical models and their field theories. And so he mentions Maxwell and Faraday, who are, you know, generally known as the discoverers or founders of electromagnetism and the first, you know, electromagnetic equations describing that force. Their idea of using things, thinking of things as a field, it's not so much an empty box of space and the ether and things propagate somehow, but everything's kind of this extended field and everything can be seen as a modification of that field or, you know, higher intensity of the field. I think those ideas inspired much of his later thinking about field theories and his sort of quest for this ultimate unified field that would explain everything. But in terms of other sort of spiritual influences, there's Spinoza, of course, but there's also, we haven't touched on yet, there's the whole Eastern influence, which is also a super fascinating part of his life. And a lot of this came from reading the philosopher Arthur Schopenhauer, who I highly recommend, who's a brilliant, just a beautiful, brilliant writer, very much a Kantian in his approach to things, but then takes a little spin on it and incorporates all this Eastern wisdom as well. And he quotes a lot from the Upanishads, actually, which is this ancient Indian, there's multiple schools, but the most famous one is non-dualist, the Advaita Vedanta school, which is a very non-dualist, very similar to what we've been talking about, except, you know, you drop the physics terms or the mathematics, but they're also talking about this unity, this oneness, the divine order that gives rise to everything and that everything returns back to. Very, very similar ideas on a kind of, on a higher level, or on a, I don't even want to say a metaphorical level, because I think they are talking about the same thing. It's actually on a quite literal level, but it's sort of, it, because mathematics and mysticism seem so separate to most of us, they don't seem to connect that easily, but I think they do. And he was quite well aware of that, not just from reading Schopenhauer. He read many of Gandhi's books. I saw myself, he had more books by Gandhi in his library than probably anybody else. And he said repeatedly in letters and so on that he'd studied Gandhi's works really carefully. And again, most people don't know much about Gandhi's religious views or what inspired his, you know, sense of pacifism and this, like, all humans are equal and unified and we must be one and no violence. He also came from the same place of this non-dualistic, unified worldview, kind of worshiping Brahman, which is kind of the word for oneness or the divine everything. And Einstein was well aware of this. And he also met, I think, probably the most interesting part of it is not just what he read, but he met in person with Rabindranath Tagore, who is a famous poet, a Bengali poet, first non-European to win the Nobel Prize for literature. And him and Einstein met three times when Tagore had been traveling through Europe and had these conversations. And there's a couple of them have been preserved, actually. And in one of them, he talks about the Upanishads and Atman and Brahman and how Atman, you know, the individual divine spark, is unified with Brahman and it's all one thing in the end. Excuse me. And so I focused on that quite a bit in the book, that he had this long conversation with this guy who's known to be this non-dualistic mystic poet who is, you know, very, very steeped in these worldviews. And actually that was just a few months before Einstein published his sort of his key paper on the cosmic religion, introducing it to the world in 1930. So I feel like the influence is quite obvious there, that this Eastern non-dual worldview fed into his sort of understanding of what he was doing with science.
Wow, what a fascinating book. It's the one that I picture carrying around, and you sit down when you're in a certain space and you read 20 or 30 pages. It's so interesting. It's interesting how you got here, Kieran, and we need to wrap up, but wondering, you know, you study medicine and the neuroscience, but obviously you've had so many influences from so many other things, including physics. And it just makes me wonder what you're working on now in your research at UCSF, right?
Yeah.
University of California, San Francisco.
Yeah. I'm mostly doing clinical work right now. I'm in residency, so there's a lot of time in the hospital, and I'm kind of getting that taken care of. And I will have more research time coming up in a few months, but I'm tied in right up now with a research group. It's Robin Carhart-Harris, who does research on the neuroscience of psychedelics. And you know, where there's a lot of things in the works. We're doing that currently, though, with doing research on psilocybin with fMRI scanners. And moving forward, I think we'll be doing more and more clinical work as well to sort of see what the benefits of this can be for people with, you know, people with depression, PTSD, whatever the case might be. So just sort of exploring what we can achieve with psychedelics and hopefully experimenting with new psychedelic substances as well, not just psilocybin.
Wow, interesting. Well, we may have to have you back on the show. Maybe sometime when you visit Park City, we'll have you on the show live to talk about that research. But
Sounds
today, of
good.
course, we're talking about your new book, I Am Part of Infinity. It's the spiritual journey of Albert Einstein. Our guest has been Dr. Kieran Fox. Kieran, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thanks for having me on.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Katie Mullally.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
So many of the books that attempt to alter our behaviors or opinions about the environment and our role in its destruction try hard but fail. We don't change. We don't think that it is our problem or that we as individuals can do much. So why try? And all these data and facts that these well-intentioned sources throw at us, well, they quickly bounce off. Well, author Timothy Morton is taking a new approach with no facts allowed. Drawing on philosophers Kant and Heidegger, Timothy is reframing what it means to be ecological and what sorts of actions count as we barrel head-on into an age of mass extinction. Timothy, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Gosh, thank you for having me. It's an honor and a pleasure to be on the show.
Your book is focusing on being ecological, where so many sources and books and people focus on being environmental or sustainable. What's the difference in your mind?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, you know, what you said at the beginning, right? Like, we know what to do, roughly. You know, we know to drastically curtail or stop or whatever that is, fossil fuel emissions really, really soon. The interesting question is, why aren't we doing it? And since, you know, it's only ethical for me to take responsibility myself for the problems that I see around me, I can only assume that people like me who write about, you know, ecology, philosophy, environmental culture, and so on and so on, we're doing something wrong. We're getting it wrong. Like, what can I do? So when Penguin, MIT have just reissued this book with a new preface by me, and I'm super happy about how it looks. And Penguin is the international publisher. And when they asked me to do it, in 2014, I was basically like, Penguin Books, huge, big Penguin Books. I'm a scholar. Nobody knows me, right? Penguin Books have just handed me a golden microphone to say something to people. So what do I say to people? And what I want to say to people is what I figured out as a teacher, what I figured out as a dad, right? Because in a sort of a way, being an environmentalist is a little bit like being a teacher or being a parent. There's a sense of obligation. There's a sense of like, I have to follow these rules. I have to do certain things. And you can kind of get hamstrung by this kind of inner pressure, you know? And so part of it might be that people like me are talking to everyone, ironically, in an unintendedly religious way, trying to make them feel bad, right? So after many years of screwing up being a parent, I figured out, you know, I don't have to be a dad because I am a dad. Right. Like it's also the same as being a teacher. I've been teaching at university for over 35 years. And at some point, right. So for the first few years, I wanted to really get everybody to like me and I wanted to like my job and everything. And then I suddenly realized I don't really have to be a teacher because I am a teacher. What does it mean? Is it someone in the class knows that I'm the teacher? Right. Someone in the house knows that I'm the dad. Right. I don't have to be in charge of that bit. And maybe, you know, why to do all these ecological actions. There's so many books that kind of tell you what to do, but why to do them You know, why to do them in the biggest possible way so that you don't have to feel like you have to like throw away your beliefs or your politics or your ideas. And for me, that would be just knowing in your heart that you are a life form, which, you know, we read this, we think we know it, right? It's, oh, sure, I'm a life form. I come from evolution, or I was created by God, or a little bit of both. But the main thing about me is I'm alive, as opposed to this brick over here, right? But funnily enough, this thing that seems so obvious isn't. And like, I'm a humanities professor, and that's what we look at all the time, like stuff that seems so obvious that it would be stupid to even think about it. And our job is to think about it, right? So it's like the most obvious thing about me might be in a way further away experientially than like the black hole in the middle of the Milky Way. How to feel like I'm alive, how to feel like I'm connected to other life forms. And we say this, right? So, oh, we must realize that we're all part of this web circle of life. You know, we say it to ourselves, but are we actually feeling it, right? And I feel like, no, maybe we're not. And so I wrote this book trying to kind of almost kind of trick myself into it, right, first. And then maybe other people can kind of come along with me for the ride.
Timothy, it's interesting talking about, you know, who your audience might be and who the audience is for ecology and for environmentalism. And to me, it seems as though we just, like, it is such an overwhelming question. It's the most pressing topic of our time, the most pressing crisis of our time. And yet, how many of us really change the way we live? For me, it was not until, you know, we live in a desert, we should be conserving water. It was not until our well failed and we had to bring in water in in containers that I really learned about conserving water. And so is part of it that we need to make it our own topic. We need to experience it for ourselves, not from what some possibly pedantic person is going to be doing in a book that we feel guilty if we don't read.
Yeah, for real. Absolutely, yes. But can you tell there's a but coming up in the sentence of it? So the well, sure, but we're talking about a planet scale problem that might engulf everybody in flames or in water and might be responsible for a mass extinction event, a really, really rapid one. Like the fifth one on the planet was the end Permian extinction, which was a global warming event. And this took several tens of thousands of years and it wiped out all but 4% of life. What happens when it takes a couple of hundred? That's what we're scared of, right? So in a way, my job is to kind of convince you that the well, unquote, already malfunctioned without freaking you out so much that you feel paralyzed, because that's the trouble. So people like me kind of accidentally, sometimes deliberately, we terrorize people with this. And when you feel terrorized, like you're in a state of fright, like I'm a trauma survivor, right? So it's like you feel paralyzed. You know, they talk about reign of terror of a tyrant. You know, it's designed to make you feel paralyzed, right? So how can you feel you've got this huge big problem and it makes you feel so tiny, like a little baby, you know, and these big corporations are actually committing criminal actions on our bodies. It's a very regressing and awful, like you feel so small. How can you in that moment also feel really grown up and you have some wiggle room to act, right? So my job is to kind of persuade you that there's something awful is happening, but realistic awful, like I'm not going to sugarcoat it. It's awful. But I mean, my hero is Ripley. I was so happy that Kamala Harris said it. Her hero was Ripley from Alien. You know, Ripley knows how to act immediately when Alien shows up. She's not frozen, right? And she knows you can't really fight Alien, but she sort of instinctively knows what to do. And I feel like as a trauma survivor, I use a lot of that stuff to help people understand this planet scale thing.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Professor of English at Rice University, Timothy Morton. He's also the author of the reprint of Being Ecological. Timothy, you bring up a good point. We don't want to scare people because then we freeze. But you also say in the book, we need to reframe climate change, global warming, whatever new terminology is being used, because it constantly adapts, to just plain old mass extinction. How can we turn that into something that isn't terrifying and traumatizing that causes us to freeze as well?
Well, my first impulse is to say, gosh, I don't know. You know, I really, honestly, it's huge and big and terrifying. And I can only really rely on my experience of having... So I grew up adjacent to a crime syndicate, actually. I grew up adjacent to the infamous Cray Twins of London. My father overlapped with the Cray Twins. And at the age of 10, I was introduced to one of their assassins. They were sitting on the floor of my dad's living room. And my dad was basically like, hey, this is Lofty. You know, of course, he's called Lofty. You know, immediately, also the little tiny pinprick zombie pupils. My 10-year-old mind was like, you're a psychopath. I don't want to be anywhere near you, right? So sort of identifying criminality, you know, and we've got kind of like criminality happening at planet scale in a certain way. And some people ready to ride roughshod over everybody else, right? And so I guess the first rule of how to survive a horror movie, you know, it is a horror movie. This is the trouble, right? I'm not going to try to sugarcoat it. I think rule number one, you're in a horror movie. You know, you're not in a rom-com. You're not in a, you know, war movie. You're not in a tragedy. This is a horror movie. Yeah, you know that, right? In other words, there's a way in which what we're confronting here feels like I'm confronting some kind of supernatural level thing. It's not a quote-unquote natural event. It's a kind of cataclysm, right? And there's all these people, of course, around us talking about apocalypse, you know, and kind of not, some very often sort of not helping, ironically. And so, like, how can someone like me talk in a way that engages with that feeling where the best, you can bring out the best in yourself? You know, I don't necessarily want to call it God, because some people might not call it God, right? And some people might call it history. Some people might call it, you know, consciousness. Some people might call it all kinds of things, right? But that aspect of one's being and behavior that's just like the best of you. And how can you inspire that to happen while you feel crushed? You know, I decided very deliberately in this book to adopt a kind of, because this book is really for Americans. I wrote this book for American people. I live in America. I'm a citizen of America. And I wrote it for us, but ironically, 7 years ago when I first published it, I was doing all this stuff around the world about this idea that I had called hyperobjects. And I was super, super busy doing these exhibitions and everything. I was doing this movie with Jeff Bridges, and it was just so busy. And I couldn't really talk about the book. So thank you for giving me this opportunity to do this, right? And so I chose this kind of faux naive, you know, like, what do I love about Sesame Street? What do I love about The Muppet Show? There is a kind of gentle, kind of like a faux naive quality to how Grover, Cookie Monster, they talk to you, right? It's like a sort of childlike, with not necessarily childish, you know, kind of open-minded. We were talking before we recorded about Laurie Anderson, who is endorsing the book on the cover. And one of the fun things that she did in the 80s with David Byrne of Talking Heads, I think, was to use this kind of faux naive sound to bring a lot of people in. Like, so there's an album called Little Creatures, and in the sleeve, it's a Talking Heads album. David Byrne's written all these aphorisms, right? These little maxims, you know. And one of them says, nuclear weapons could destroy the earth if used properly. And you read it, you're like, it's kind of funny and weird and kind of uncanny. And like, you know, there's a range of emotions around and inside the horror. You don't have to stay stuck in the horror. You can find something else kind of inside of it. And so my job is like, how do I give people the wiggle room on the inside, you know, to given all of that?
Yeah, so Timothy, stuck in the horror. When I think of what we're facing with our climate crisis as a mass extinction, that really sticks me in the horror. And so how, with your book being ecological, do we, where is that wiggle room that you're talking about that makes it something other than
utter horror.
Mm-hmm. Well, here's
something
a funny
that we
thing.
We can actually do something about or become active.
Here's a funny thing then, right? Like, so think to yourself, like, when were we not going extinct, right? Like, maybe we will go extinct really soon. When were life forms ever not going extinct? When were we ever not dying? You know, and it's hard. I mean, I personally have no intention of dying. I've heard it happens to other people a lot, you know. So as I speak, I'm aware of my own hypocrisy, but that's the work, right? You've got to realize death kind of shadows you all the time, whether or not you're physically dying, right? And it's kind of existential, right? There's a lot of, like, dare I say, gas mileage, electrical car mileage left in sort of existentialism, which is like before you've having an idea about what you're doing, like where are you at, you know? And where we're at as, like, mortal beings is that it was never not true that we were too many negatives in the sentence. We were always dying. We're always going extinct, right? It's the sort of refreshing quality of just knowing this is life. The other thing, of course, you know, morally, how to rise to the occasion, right? I mean, as a parent, you know, I might get hit by that truck, but I got to get my son out of the way. I'm just going to, you know, I'm going to die for this person. And sort of how to encourage people to, because that's what it is, right? You're human being relative. I'm not even talking about dolphins or frogs or whatever. I'm saying you, like you were just saying, you know, your next door neighbor, your family could die at a flood, fire, some kind of awfulness, right? And how to sort of just kind of rise to the occasion despite that. And it's sort of like, we know what this is, right? Especially as Americans, actually. I was on a train to DC to visit my girlfriend. It was a long time ago, it was like 30 years ago. And the train derailed. And, you know, in Britain, that would have been the end. It would have been the entire night, we just stood there frozen in the snow, shaking, right? But because it was America, they got a crane and they picked up the train, they put it back on the line, and on it went to DC. And I remember the conductor running through the train going, everything's peachy. And I thought, you know, if there was ever a time to not say everything's peachy, it's right now on this train. But it was super American, right? I was in a plane where the engine caught fire and we landed an emergency landing. And unlike in a movie where all the Americans are screaming, the Americans were awesome. All the lights went out, the attendant said, everybody get off the plane. In a very, very calm, very firm, we all got off the plane, everybody was okay, right? We know what this is instinctively. We just never thought to like combine those feelings with, like, I don't know, forests and, you know, whatever, fish and other life forms.
Timothy, first of all, I don't think I'm going to be traveling with you anytime soon because it doesn't seem that you have the best of luck. However, you've survived, so maybe that is an extraordinary set of circumstances and luck that you bring to any situation. But let's talk about, like, we need to start feeling this, but we've all become, I don't know if we've become this or we've always have been so removed from everything. Is it our upbringing? Mm. Is it the industrial complex? Why have we all been led to think that we aren't a part? Nature is out there. Ecology is out there. Life and animals are out there. We are separate from that. We build our little homes, our little cars, and we do as much as we can to not have to be out there amongst all the living creatures. Mm-hmm. How did this happen?
Mm-hmm. This is on my mind all the time, you know, and I've written about it quite a lot in other places too. And I just published this book called In Search of a Christian Ecology. So I'm trying to think about this issue a little bit in the key of thinking about religion, yeah? And a lot of people like me like to repeat some kind of fall narrative. Like, once upon a time, we were totally connected to the natural world, and then we just got it wrong and we blew it. And we blew it because we had this or that. You know, there's an essay by Jared Diamond, the worst mistake in the history of the human race. It's agriculture, right? But when you look at it, actually, there's ways of doing agriculture that are not going to do that to the planet. So what is it, right? So I'm going to give a kind of honest anthropological answer in a minute. But first of all, I'm going to give a weird psychedelic answer, because that's what I think that I do for my job, which is basically this funny feeling of being separated is exactly how being in feels, right? You're in a car crash. Another disaster to do with transportation. What's going on here? You're in a car crash, and the first your feeling about it is, wow, this isn't happening. This is unreal. The funny feeling, like, when is the global warming going to really kick in? When is it really going to happen? That's the symptom of it's happening, right? This funny feeling of disconnection. Neurologically, you are separated from your biosphere by a few hundred milliseconds all the time, right? Like, I'm talking into this mic, and my body is in the present moment, but my brain, which is part of my body, but my sensation of it is a few hundred milliseconds in the past, right? And my sense of self, like just basic head, shoulders, knees, and toes, sense of self, just neurologically speaking, is just a kind of silhouette inversion of that, right? So my sense of self is delayed a little further by another few hundred milliseconds. So literally all the time, just by being sentient. So the good news is plants have this feeling of separation, right? If plants are sentient, fish, there's probably some kind of fish radio show where some kind of fish is going, why do we always feel so separate from the rest of the biosphere, right? Since when was it true that all the other animals were like, we're better than those humans because we feel integrated into it? Like, maybe they also have funny existential crises. Maybe they also have David Byrne, Laurie Anderson. So that's one answer, right? Another answer, for some reason, societies that became very successful stopped being playful, and they were farmer-centric. It wasn't about agriculture. It was about the seriousness. It was about a kind of implicitly conservative, this is how we did it last year, so we must do it again next year, and we don't quite know why, just follow the rules. And this is why we live in this kind of very rule-based, very almost like a computer program world, where, like the Inuit, you know, they're communists in the winter and they're monarchists in the summer. Like, we never think, oh, we could change our social structure, like we could be more playful. And right now might be a good time to remember we don't have to feel stuck in this kind of algorithm. I'm not talking about capitalism or Soviet whatever in particular. I'm talking about something kind of underlying it.
Timothy, thank you for republishing this book, because it couldn't come out at a more perfect time. Was this timing intentional with what's happening to all of our environmental and science-based programs?
Do you know what, Katie? It actually was. So I was finishing up the final production on the book called Hell, in Search for Christian Ecology, which is also just happening right now. And I realized this would be a really good moment to talk to MIT about reissuing the book. Now, the stuff that has been happening very recently pertaining to funding being cut, one didn't know specifically, but as a survivory person, I had a really good idea what could happen in the future. And in a funny way, my books often do accidentally. This really is an accident. It's not my conscious intention. It's something to do with my brain is great. My idea of myself is terrible, but my brain's pretty good. And I do write in a kind of slightly predictive way. So I'm very grateful to you for having me on the show so that I can sort of talk that, you know, and hopefully people get some sense of this book could give you a sort of like some kind of coordinates, like not mm-hmm. like not practical, but psychological, kind of philosophical coordinates. Yeah.
Timothy, before we let you go, I want to ask you, from your psychological, philosophical approach, what do you say to when we go backwards? The president wants to reverse coal's decline. That sounds to, I would think, most people, that's going backwards.
Mm-hmm.
How do you reckon with that, with the way you look at things?
Yeah. I have a very strict practice that I do right now, you know, which is to, I just replace every content of every headline with the word crime and every person with the word criminal. It's much more energy efficient to imagine a newspaper that say criminals commit crimes, then, you know, the editorial, criminals are very often criminal people. And then at the bottom of the page, yesterday, crimes were committed. Yeah. Holding on to what, you know, it's not even holding on to some idea of the past. It's not even going backwards, is what I would like to say. Because, of course, really, while you feel like you might be going backwards, you're actually plundering and like blundering and plundering, Freudian slip, headlong into the future with your plan, right? So, you know, you're still munching down the biosphere at a colossal rate, yeah. And so I kind of feel like, I don't know, ideology is a funny word, but it's almost like we sometimes perceive the world upside down, right? And so this idea that we're going back is actually a way of steaming ahead into the future and damn the torpedoes.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Timothy, this is such a fascinating and important conversation. I think everyone needs to read this book because the ideas of no facts allowed, but really coming at it from a philosophical perspective and really addressing the why. I think a lot of people are understanding the element of why we should, why we haven't, why we can actually do something. So thank you for re-releasing this book. Our guest today has been Timothy Morton. He is the author of the re-release book, Being Ecological. Well, Timothy, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so very much for having me.
You've been listening to KPCW Park City at 91.7 and 88.1 FM in Summit County and 91.9 FM in Wasatch County. Stream us live on kpcw.org and the KPCW app, or ask your smart speaker to play KPCW. And you can hear past shows if you go to KPCW under the Shows tab and click on Cool Science Radio. There's all of our shows from previous weeks to listen. And next week, tune in. We're having a fascinating conversation with one-time local Peter Rizzo about his time as a physician in Antarctica and another author about talking how we can actually use AI in our small businesses. That's all next week on Cool Science Radio.